So this next speaker, I find him very interesting because I think most of you who've seen him on stage, some of you have seen him as the Mentalist. I'm sure you are familiar with the US program, the Mentalist. But I've seen him on various platforms, and he's actually really great. I'm going to welcome on stage Gilan Gork. His presentation is going to be looking at unlocking growth in an increasingly uncertain world. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Gilan Gork.
Good morning, good morning. How are you all doing? Good? Yes? Excellent. Oh, I'm so excited to be here today. Thank you for the lovely introduction. It's great to see you again. Maybe. I am interested. You heard that I'm a mentalist. You've seen on screen it said I'm a mentalist, but I was just kind of looking from behind the room when I was being introduced. Who here actually knows what a mentalist is? Can I just see from a show of hands? Put up your hands if you know what a mentalist is. Let me see who you are in the room. Yeah, no, not one person. All right, put up your hand if you have never seen a mentalist before. You have no idea what a mentalist is. Great, put down your hand. And based on what I'm seeing here right now, put up your hand if you're not going to put up your hand no matter what I ask. Come on, I know who you are. Yes, thank you for being honest. Okay, let me explain to you what a mentalist is by telling you what a mentalist is not. Now, a mentalist is not a psychic, right? Even though some of the stuff that you may have, if you've ever seen me before on radio or TV, a lot of people remember the episode where I was on Carte Blanche. And I've got to be careful how I say that because a lot of people think that they were like kicking my door down with like hidden cameras. I was on their team. And it was quite a few years ago, but a lot of people remember it. I was driving an Aston Martin. They put me in this car with the late Derek Watts next to me. They put us on Swartkopf's racetrack. And before going out on the track, they said, Gilan, we put obstacles on the track and you can't see them. And they put a steel blindfold over my eyes and a black bag over my head. And I had to just try and navigate that racetrack, just trying to sense what Derek was looking at and focusing on. And at one point, you can watch the video on my website, at one point he loses focus and we nearly drive off the track. I mean, like something like that may seem like there's some kind of psychic or supernatural powers, but I'm the first to admit there absolutely is nothing psychic or supernatural about me. There's actually quite an academic side to being a mentalist, things like influence and psychology, nonverbal communication. Who here has actually seen the TV show? You mentioned the TV show, The Mentalist. Put up your hand if you are familiar with The Mentalist TV show. Yes? All right. Excellent. Well, his character is loosely based on someone like me, but who pretended to have psychic powers. And then the story goes on. They work for the FBI. But I thought to myself, in case there's anyone here who does not, who's not familiar with what a mentalist is, why don't we start off with maybe a little mentalist experiment? Are you guys keen? Let's do it. All right. So this is actually something that's a bit nostalgic for me because it's based on a game that I used to enjoy playing when I was a kid. I'm the youngest of four children. I grew up in Joburg, although I live in Cape Town now. But my parents still live in the same home with the same, it's got the same games cupboard of the games that we used to play with over 40 years ago. And my parents actually owned an educational toy center. So I grew up with games and puzzle. I never had toy guns and stuff like that. But one of my favorite games that I used to play was a murder mystery board game. Now, if I say that, which game comes to mind? Just call it out altogether. It is Cluedo. Put up your hand if you're familiar with Cluedo. Yes, excellent. Okay, this will be a little trip down memory lane for some of you, for most of you. For those of you who are not familiar with Cluedo, let me share with you what Cluedo is about. And here is a Cluedo board that is on screen. Now, Cluedo was a murder mystery game. You had to work out who killed who, in what part of the house, with which weapon. So, for example, it could have been in the library, it could have been Miss Scarlet with the gun. You would win the game if you could work out what was the secret information that was hidden inside the envelope. Now, the way that I used to try and play the game is I would try and, obviously knowing what I was holding, I would try and trick my friend psychologically into giving away what they were thinking. And then through some reverse engineering, I'd kind of work out what was inside the envelope, right? Now, this was when I was really young. I had no idea that being a mentalist could even exist. But this is how I kind of started playing around with these types of things. So I have with me some of the Cluedo cards from that very first set that my parents still own, except some of the pieces have gone missing. So I've only got five of the six weapons over here. And some you guys will remember the weapons, right? So there was a knife. You all remember the knife, those of you familiar with the game. Now, the next weapon is the one that, for some reason, people who played the game just always remember it. It's like the most popular weapon, which is the The candlestick. Who said the candle? The candle. Yeah, the candlestick. It is the most popular one, maybe because it's not the obvious weapon. Like, how do you use it? There's many ways, probably, that you could. But there's a lead pipe, there's a rope, and there is a gun. All right, so I'm going to need 5 people to help me recreate a bit of a mentalist experiment over here. By the way, you know when a teacher walks into a classroom and the kids that didn't do their homework, they're like, look away. They're like, if I don't see you, you don't see. If you do that, you're actually a really good candidate for this experiment. So, sir, would you go ahead and grab one of the guys over there? Thanks. All right. Let me come down here. Would you go ahead and grab one? It really doesn't matter which one. I'm going to have you kind of change them all up in just a moment. Go ahead and grab one over here. Let me come right to the back where people thought they were safe. And yes, right over here. Would you grab this one over here and all the way on the end over here? Who will we get between the two of you? All right. If I gave you a card, will you just hold it up above your head just so I can see where you are? There should be 5 of you. 1, 2, 3, 4. Actually, stand up for us. Go ahead and stand up. Actually, join me up here on stage. Join me. Give them a big round of applause as they come up here. And make a straight line. Make a straight line over here. Now, here's a promise. Let me make some space here for you. I'm not going to make an idiot of any of you. I'm not like, that's not the kind of thing that we're going to be doing here. This is actually going to be quite fun, even for you over here. I'm going to turn my back towards you. When I do that, I want you to quickly gather together. Swap the cards out amongst yourselves. You're going to land up with either the same but likely different weapon than you're holding now. You need to know which weapon you end up with once you swap them out. Don't make another conference of it. So don't like try and psychoanalyze and have a discussion of, I think Gilan thinks that, I think that, he thinks that. Just do it randomly. Know which weapon you've got. Then you're going to stand back where you are and you're going to hold it sandwiched in your hands like this. So when I turn around, I can't see what it is. But you need to imagine that you're holding the weapon. Now, if you've got the gun card, don't do that. You know, like, don't make it obvious for me, right? Because I don't want you to give away at all what the weapon is. But I do want you to imagine, even though it's the card in your hand, I want you to imagine that it's the weapon. And just relax as well. Like, don't tense up. Just nice and relaxed. That's pretty easy, right? Pretty good. I'm going to turn my back. Go ahead, gather together. Everybody, you know, all the skeptics can look into my eyes and see that I'm not cheating or anything like that. Why do you look so nervous when you look into my... No? Your secret is safe with me, huh? It's safe. No, I'm just kidding. All right. I'm buying time here, but I don't want to turn around, but those of you behind me, I'm talking to you, I'm staged. You all have a weapon, and you know what it is, and you're imagining holding it in your hand, and you're relaxed. All right. At this point, would you agree that no one in this entire room could possibly know what our friends are thinking? Unless you can read minds. No, not psychic. You're going to actually see, and I want you to play this game in your seat as well and see if you can try and tell what our friends are thinking here. And I want for you guys to just try your absolute best not to give away at all what you're thinking. This will make them give away what they're thinking, right? Ironically. Okay, I'm actually going to start this side. And I don't want to turn my back to everyone, so just turn to face me here. Just imagine holding that weapon, whatever it is. Repeat after me. Say out loud in a clear voice. Say knife.
Knife.
Louder. Knife.
Knife.
Candlestick.
Candlestick.
Lead pipe.
Lead pipe.
Rope.
Rope.
Gun.
Gun.
Lead pipe.
Lead pipe.
Rope.
Rope.
Lead pipe.
Lead pipe.
Rope.
Rope.
Okay. So I don't know if anybody here. It's not easy. It's not easy. We're always looking for a couple of different cues and clues, right? And so I'm always also looking for the norm when it comes to these things. You want to look at how is somebody normally, and then are there any changes, especially when they start thinking that you're getting closer to figuring out what it is that they're thinking. I'm just curious. On the count of three, call out what you think it is. 1, 2, 3. All right, so I did kind of whittle it down to kind of lead pipe and rope that may have cued some of you in. I'm going to go with the lead pipe. Now, by the way, when I say what I think you have, you don't need to say yes or no. In fact, that would just increase my chances. We don't want that, right? But I did notice that, as I said, the lead pipe, you did give subtly a kind of a little... You see, now he's trying very hard to control his face right now. which is just giving me further confirmation that I didn't yet have before, but now I have it. I do think that it is the lead pipe. So you can go ahead and stand over here. Thank you. The lead pipe. All right. The lead pipe. Say lead pipe.
Lead pipe.
Just checking something. Imagine holding it. Say knife.
Knife.
Candlestick.
Candlestick.
Rope.
Rope.
Gun.
Gun.
Quickly, knife.
Knife.
Candlestick.
Candlestick.
Rope.
Rope.
Gun.
Gun.
Imagine holding this thing. All right, it's one of the heavier ones. But he's got the, you got the rope. You've got the rope. So we got the cat, we got the lead pipe, and we've got the rope, I think. All of this is tentative. Don't change places because my memory's not that good. So I have to remember which order you're in. All right, so I think we've got the, what did I say? The lead pipe and the rope. The lead pipe and the rope. Okay. Relaxing. Say lead pipe.
Lead pipe.
Say rope.
Rope.
Knife.
Knife.
Candlestick.
Candlestick.
Gun.
Gun.
Knife,
knife,
candlestick,
candlestick,
gun,
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 candlestick,
candlestick,
knife,
knife.
I will get back to you. I will get back to you. Half an art and half a science. You can stand over here. All right. Nice and relaxed. Just imagine holding this thing. Say candlestick. Say gun.
Gun.
Hold on 1 second. There's something going on here. Because, hold on, you see, here's the thing. I'm watching everyone all the time. He didn't realize, he thought it's not his turn yet, right? And so if he was focusing, because he was staring at her, he would have seen that I was looking at him. You saw that I was looking right over your shoulder, right? You would probably not even realize it. But when she said gun, you became a little bit more tense, a little bit more, almost like, and he probably wouldn't have even realized that this was happening, that he's a little bit more interested in like what, because I think that that's his weapon. So it's like how she reacts might influence whether I land up getting that he's got the gun. So I actually think that you have got the gun. Well, he's trying very hard not to give anything away. In fact, out of all of them, I'm the most convinced that he's got the gun. So hold on. So if I'm right that we've got the lead pipe and the rope and the gun, then one of you has got the candlestick and one of you has got the knife. Say knife.
Knife.
Say knife.
Knife.
Candlestick.
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 Imagine using this thing. All right. So just imagine holding it in your hand. Do you see how when I ask you to imagine, because I'm not getting any kind of feedback on the whether it's heavy or not or light or not, but something interesting, when I asked you to imagine using it within a very short period of time, you gave a nod. Did you all see that she gave a nod? Very quickly, so which means that she could imagine using it relatively quickly. Now, which one did we say is not the obvious weapon? The candlestick. So I think it would have taken you longer to imagine using it, which means that you've got the knife, you've got the candlestick. So that means that we've got the lead pipe, the rope, the candlestick, the knife, and the gun. If I'm wrong about one, I could be wrong about all of them. Show us what you have. I'm the most convinced that you have got the gun. Yes, he has got the gun. 1 out of 5. Have we got the lead pipe? Go ahead and show us. Yes, we've got the lead pipe, the rope, we've got the rope, and the candlestick, and the knife. 5 out of 5. Give them a big round of applause as well. Thank you so much for helping. Thank you. Appreciate your help. You guys can take your seat. I really appreciate your help up here. Thank you. Thank you, guys. You're good sports. Whew. I get as excited, by the way, because you never know right up until the end if you're actually going to get it all right. And I've gotten this stuff wrong on live TV before, and there's just no coming back from that, to be honest. Now, we could probably spend time, if we had it, which we don't, there's a lot of different lessons here. You think that this is a demonstration of just being able to read body language, but it's so much more than that. There's a lot of psychology that goes into it. And I want to maybe just draw one specific observation that will link into what we're going to be talking about here today, because I'm not here today to talk about how to read or decode people's thoughts through their reactions and body language, but there is a parallel I want to draw. Did you notice that how everyone here behaved, their reactions, the things that they decided to do or not to do, or how they decided that they were going to say things? So their decisions, their reactions, their behaviors, a lot of that wasn't just logical. There were certain things that I was doing up here to put pressure on them as well. There's a certain pace, there's certain questions, there's the fact that they're even up here in front of everybody. Would you agree that whichever way that they were reacting was not so logical as it was emotional, but it was unfolding as a behavior, right? Look at, for example, just a classic one, the gent at the end over here, how without even realizing it, he was emotionally reacted when she was saying his weapon and we were right at the end, and that then impacted his behavior. And so what I want to draw here, which is something so important, and I wish I learned earlier on in my life, is that as logical as we believe our reactions, decisions, and behaviors are, it's our emotions, it's our inner game that really dictates how all of that comes up. And you're going to see that come up in a story that I'm going to tell you in just a moment. As you know, I'm here to share with you how to unlock not just your growth potential, but also the growth potential of the people in your teams and ultimately the entire organization. No matter who you are, you have influence on everybody around you. And I want to share this with you in the context of us being in an increasingly uncertain world. We know that that is a theme here today. But I don't just want to kind of, I don't want to sit here and tell you what you need. For example, these six really, really crucial norms over here, I'll be preaching to the converted if I say this is what you need. You probably already know that to be able to navigate an ever-changing financial landscape, political landscape, you know, the world is just changing faster and faster. We know that that's all changing. We know that there's certain disruptions, whether it be AI, you know, is that going to be friend or foe? How do we collaborate? How do we innovate to be able to work around certain things like regulations? You know, there's things like Regulation 28 that has consequences. Now, how do we innovate around that? How do we influence not just ourselves but others to be able to deal with all everything that comes our way? And the change is just becoming more and more and more. I don't want to just sit here and tell you this is what you need and spend my time talking about that, but I want to show you how you can get these six things working in your life and in your team, and what really stops us from bringing our highest level of growth and performance in the form of these six demands that our ever-changing, in an increasingly uncertain world, demands from us. So that's what I want to leave you with. By the end of our short time here today, I want to plant an idea in your mind, a belief that will unfold into all of these norms over here that will help you to navigate this uncertain world. I don't want to spend a lot of time on my story, but maybe just enough to give a little bit of context as to why what I'm sharing with you is so important and how I actually came to learn it. So I started off in entertainment, kind of doing the types of experiments that we did here, but you know, probably nowhere near as complex. But this was me just after school, and I was in the entertainment industry. And for various reasons that we don't have time to chat about here today, I decided to move into the expert industry, which is speaking, training, coaching, and all of that kind of stuff. And I had absolutely no influence in that space, but I had to make a decision to develop my influence. And when I made the decision to develop influence in this brand new context, I recorded how I did it. I created certain frameworks and formulae. For example, you may have come across, if you follow my work, my rapid influence formula, which is my way of deconstructing influence so that you can more predictably have a positive influence on other people in all the contexts that you saw in the introduction video. And I made a pretty good career going around the world. I've presented now in over 40 countries, have a best-selling book, and I have really had the privilege of presenting these ideas of influence on the international stage at some really prestigious events. One of my career highlights being the opening keynote speaker for NATO at their Stratcom conference in Europe a few years ago. And, well, stop it. You guys. No. I'm going to tell you a story of how it all went wrong at NATO. So hold your applause. It didn't all go wrong, but there was an important lesson that I want to share with you from my experience there. Here's what I discovered, is that I was spending so much time speaking about the outer game of influence that for way too long I ignored the inner game of influence, which is really what I want to chat about here today. We can have all the skill set, we can have all the knowledge, but I really have come to believe that mindset precedes skill set. With the right mindset, we can not only develop the right skill set, you know this because you develop certain skills, you have to have the right mindset to engage in that process and put in the effort, but when we're in situations where there's pressure and change and there's lots of emotions, and we spoke about emotions before, have we found that as much personal development as we've gone on, so often our behavior, our reactions, our decisions just revert back to normal, right? And I mean, think about it in a totally different context. How many people do you engage with at work, especially when it comes to their assets and so on, and they know what the right thing is to do? It makes logical sense, but emotionally they're not there yet. And that influences the decisions they make. You relate to this? So that inner game is so, so crucial. And this really hit home for me when I presented for NATO a few years ago. So here's the story. I was the opening keynote speaker. There were hundreds of people there from around 50 countries, obviously politicians. There were military, they were all there. People from academia, like deans of some of the biggest universities. The media was there, private sector, they were all there, right? It was being streamed internationally. And I was absolutely petrified. Like, who here has heard of imposter syndrome? We all know imposter syndrome? Yes. I had the biggest imposter syndrome. I was sitting there thinking to myself, here I am, this mentalist from, you know, this entertainer turned expert in South Africa, and here I am with world leaders. And I was presenting this keynote, and then I was on a panel discussion with two professors, Professor Jan Engelman and Michael Platt from Wharton School, as well as the University of Amsterdam, like head of neuroeconomics. Like, these are giants in the field. And I was on a panel discussion on how to influence decision making with them. And I was just so nervous for the entire ordeal. This is funny. You know, as kids, if you'd like rub, it's like the thing that kids do. Did you ever do it where you like rub your teeth and it's like super dry? And then, so I came out that morning. I was so, so nervous. My mouth was so dry. I smiled. I was like, good morning, everyone. And when I relaxed, I couldn't unsmile. Like my top lip got stuck to my top teeth. That's how nervous I was, right? And the little voice in my head was saying to me, you see, Gilan, you don't belong here. This is imposter syndrome, right? Look at this. Everybody else looks so cool, calm, and collected. Look at all these distinguished people. And here you are, just feeling so nervous, got all the butterflies in your stomach, you got this dry mouth, like, why are you even here? This is the voice in my head. And so you can imagine the emotions that those narratives started to create. And the narrative that it created, which I didn't identify on the day, was that I best be perfect. There was no room for error, just to feel like I deserved, that like I belonged there, that I was good enough, that, you know, my life was worthy enough to be in that audience. Well, you can kind of see where this is going. My 40-minute keynote, I'd rehearsed it so many times, got in the zone, and I really delivered it. You know, their press release said it was a highlight of the conference, and I'm just mentioning that point only to help my ego with what came next, because what came next was pretty horrendous, at least in my shoes on the day. I was in this panel discussion now after the keynote, and all seemed to be going well until a British journalist stood up with his phone in his hand, and he said, Gilan, what is your source for the statistic on car accidents? This was a pivotal point that I made in my talk on the rapid influence formula. And he said, because I'm looking on Google and I'm getting very different results. Has anybody ever, like, tell us a joke right now. Tell us a joke. You can't think of one. You know you've told jokes in your life. You've got jokes, right? But have you had that, like, somebody asked you and you just go blank? My source just went blank. Like, and by the way, it was the World Health Organization. How embarrassing is that? Like, who forgets the who? But anyway, I absolutely, I went totally blank. I landed up saying something like, I can't think of my source, but I know it was a good one. And the voice in my head was just going like, you see, Gilan, like, you can't forget your source in front of all of these people. You know, where were your footnotes? Where was the sata? And so again, the voice in my head got so strong that when they moved on to another question, I went down this wormhole of just thinking to myself, what was my source? What was that? Like, I don't know, had I actually then thought of it, maybe internally my dignity would have helped, but I don't know what I would have done with it. I wasn't going to like interrupt the next person like, hey, I know what my source is now. So I don't know, you know, it's like, but I got so absorbed. It was all I could think about, right? Was just at least let me remember what my source was. And I got into this little wormhole of thinking driven by the emotion of fear and anxiety and probably a bit of shame in there as well. And all of a sudden, the facilitator, who is the head of communications for the UK government, very strong personality, said, all right, we're going to end with that last question and we're going to pose it to the entire panel. And I snapped out and I thought to myself, what was the question? I was just totally zoned out, kind of emotionally just trying to think of my source. And so thankfully I thought, okay, they're starting with Professor Michael Platt. Okay, I'll figure this out. And he gave such an ambiguous answer. He was like, we don't have the research. I'm like, oh shit, okay, for what? Went on to Jan Engelman. He gave some other answer. I kind of had an idea, but didn't really. I literally had to say to them, I'm so sorry. I was still thinking about my source. Can I confirm what the question was? And then I gave an answer that in the headspace I was in with all the emotion and everything, I know I could have given a better answer. It was a really shitty answer. It was like, well, you know, like my colleague said over here, we don't really have much data on that. But like afterwards, I was like, oh, I could have said so much more. So what I learned from this, it was just a really, really stark reminder that not only did my emotions prevent me from bringing my best skill set, my best knowledge, my best influence, my leadership expertise to the moment, but afterwards was one of the next biggest lessons for me. Because I couldn't, they sent me the recording. So remember, this was streamed out. And who wouldn't want to get the recording of presenting at that kind of event? They sent it to my team. And I knew that I should have gone back and watched and learned from it. But I always had something more important to do. There was always some project I was working on. There was always something that would get in the way. And for about 7 or 8 months, I totally avoided going anywhere near that footage. But I'd never realized that I was emotionally avoiding it. In hindsight, I realized that I was petrified that if I went back and watched that footage, what I would discover is that actually I'm not good enough. But I had every logical reason that I believed at the time of why I just couldn't get to it right now. When I did finally go back and watch it, not because I wanted to go and learn anything, but because we needed an excerpt for another project, I learned a ton that significantly changed the way I communicate certain concepts and have now benefited all of my clients going forward. And I robbed clients in those 7 or 8 months of being able to learn from the things that I learned through my experience. So I totally robbed them of that learning, myself and them. Again, we can see in hindsight how clearly it is our emotional interference that comes from our narratives that can totally sabotage our effectiveness in the moment and our effectiveness afterwards to learn and adapt. And you can see some of those themes coming in that we had spoken about. So I came back and I developed this model. When I say I developed it, I adapted it from what is commonly known as the iceberg model, where you know that there's something beneath the surface that's generally unseen. But I prefer to use a carrot because I work a lot with teams, a lot of executive teams as well. And a team of people is like a garden of carrots, and you just can't have a garden of icebergs. So you'll see how the analogy kind of expands. But just imagine yourself as a carrot, right? There is part of all of us that is above the surface. In other words, there's the stuff that we can visibly see in ourselves and other people, like our reactions, decisions, and behaviors. It's the stuff that we generally try and change first. It's the stuff that all of our assessments try and assess and judge. And this is where a lot of training comes in, and the training we get is, these are the decisions, reactions, behaviors that we should bring into these situations at these times. But have you noticed that often we don't experience the change, even though we know what we should be doing? Do you work with people? Are you in a team where you know that people aspire, they know that they should be behaving in one way, but then in certain situations people revert back, like we discussed earlier? And that's because we have the under-the-surface part of ourselves, which is stuff that's not always so obvious. We're not always so mindful or aware of it in ourselves and certainly in other people as well. But it is the root cause, because a carrot is a root vegetable, right? So the healthier the root is, obviously the better and healthier the leaves will be above the surface. And so the deepest part of that root is our beliefs. Now, I'm not talking about religious beliefs, because a lot of people think that the moment they see the word belief. But a belief is an idea that we have a sense of certainty about. That's all. And there are beliefs that we have, there are ideas that we formed since we were children, that we have no idea that we even have that belief. It just becomes our truth of how we understand or experience ourselves, the world, other people. And so it's analogous to having, if I gave you a pair of shades of sunglasses that were orange tinted, and you, or contact lenses that were orange tinted, and you had it since you can remember, since you were a kid, eventually you almost forget that the world doesn't look orange, right? Everything you experience is tinted orange. That's what beliefs do. When we have certain beliefs, especially ones that we don't know we have about ourselves, others, and the world, we start to enter situations and we have certain assumptions that it gives us. And when we're in various situations, those beliefs and assumptions impact how we interpret those situations. How we interpret a situation is going to evoke certain emotions. And those emotions are what drive our reactions, decisions, and behaviors. If we want to change our or other people's top of the ground stuff, above the surface stuff, we have to always address below the surface. And so there is a specific mindset that I want to share with you here today. And when I talk about mindset, I'm not talking about positive or negative thinking. Some people just reduce it down to that. But as you can see, mindset by definition is our beliefs and assumptions that shape how we interpret the situations we're in. And even shape how we interpret ourselves. We don't go around thinking, what are my beliefs and assumptions? Although that's a pretty good question to ask ourselves. But instead, we can get a clue as to what our mindset is through our narratives. Our narratives. Now, already you remember from my NATO story that I had certain narratives around perfection and around belonging and about my skills and about even about other people and what would be required for me to feel that I deserve to be there. All of these narratives, if I had just analyzed those, I could have very quickly found this mindset. And that's actually what led me to this body of work that I want to share with you. Ultimately, what we're looking at is, what can we do below the surface in ourselves and also ignite in the people who we work with, whether that be your colleagues, but I think what you'll see here, you'll also be able to identify in clients, if you're working with clients, that will help with those six norms that we had discussed. So there's a specific pair of beliefs, and they're unintendedly conditioned into us since childhood. And we only know that we have this belief once we're presented with the alternative. But let me ask you a question that'll help to answer or help you to understand how these beliefs get instilled in us. So put up your hand, and I bet that I'll see everybody's hands up. If you have ever given positive reinforcement to a child, I'll give you an example. Child solves a puzzle really quickly. Wow! Look how quickly you did that. You're so smart. You definitely didn't get your mother's genes. You know, you definitely got my genes. Like, we have all these jokes, right? Wow, you kicked the ball you did that first time. You're so talented. Or the kid scribbles something on a piece of paper. Is that an elephant? You're so creative. How are you born so amazing? Let's put this on the fridge. Okay, let's just take the example of intellect. Like a child does something really quickly, perfectly, first time. Wow, you're so smart. You solved that so quickly. What a child hears is, if I can't solve something like that perfectly, first time, without putting in much effort, then maybe that means I'm not smart. Now, I did actually mean to ask for everybody to raise your hands if you have given positive affirmation to a child, and then I forgot to, and now it's just a shit time to ask you that, because you might put up your hand and feel guilty, like, oh no, have I messed some kid up by giving praise? No. Here's the thing, right? Why do we give praise, especially positive praise to children? It's because we feel that we're going to give them confidence, and it's going to further feed into their performance. It's going to make them even higher performing, right? We may not use those terms with kids, but that's kind of what we think is going to improve their abilities and give them that motivation. But what children land up hearing is very, very different. We land up hearing, if what I do doesn't come naturally to me, if I can't get perfect results, or at least get the validation that this is amazing and I did it so seamlessly, then maybe it means I'm not intelligent, talented, creative, whatever, right? And then children are at school and they're busy solving a puzzle, and oh, I solved my puzzle quicker than Billy solved his puzzle. That means I was born with more smarts than Billy. And so this idea, i.e. belief, starts to develop that we're born with a certain, that all of us are born with a certain level of intelligence. Hopefully we were endowed with great intelligence. Hopefully we got the good kind of gene pool. And that when I go out there and interact with the world, as children, it's at school, if I can do things easily first time with little effort, do it amazingly, get that validation, that is validation that I was born with a high amount of intelligence. If something starts to feel challenging, okay, well, I know I can overcome it, but if it starts feeling really challenging, then it starts to feel a bit threatening. Like, is this going to be the thing that's going to reveal that maybe I'm unintelligent? So we can see how these narratives start to form when we're children and how that can cause us to feel certain emotions, emotions like threat or fear or an avoidance of shame. All the same emotions that I felt when I was at NATO with my narratives. In the literature, this is a term coined by Stanford professor Carol Dweck. This is a fixed mindset, which is the belief that things like our intelligence, character, talent, that these are fixed traits that we're born with, that even if they change a little bit, they're relatively fixed. Like, hopefully you're born with a good amount of them. You're well endowed with that. And so when we enter into any situation, we tend to, through a fixed mindset lens, we tend to perceive every situation as either something that's going to validate that I was born with a high amount of it, I'm good enough, or that's going to feel threatening to reveal that I'm not good enough. So we're always then looking for that validation. Also, if we see somebody else do something amazing, we will naturally think that they were born with some special level of brilliance. We'll see that as being a reflection of their brilliance that's innate to them. But the most dangerous part of it is that we attach our performance to our identity. So if I do well, it feels great because I feel like, yes, I am a smart person. I am a talented person. But if I don't do well, well, we know how that feels, right? And so we start avoiding certain things that will put us in that situation, which is exactly what I did when I got to high school. In primary school, this is me going into primary school, I won academic awards. I was a provincial chess player. I was the lead in the school play. I was like into art and culture, but also academics. My teachers told my parents I had some unique mix of left and right brain, whatever the stereotypes were back there. We know a lot more about that here today. And so I actually thought to myself that I was a pretty smart kid. I hope I wasn't arrogant about it, but that was my belief. Pardon? I was told that I have until 8:30.
Oh, you're going to stay until 8:30. That's great.
Or I'm going to try. Oh, thank you.
Pressed for time.
I am pressed for time. I've got another event to get to. But thanks for the reminder.
Okay.
Thank you. And please remind me again in 10 minutes.
I will do so.
All right, cool. Thank you. Because I do actually need to speed up. So thank you. I appreciate that. and I lost my train of thought. Where were we? We were with knife, candlestick. Oh, yes. I got to high school. And obviously, the nature of the work got more complex. Obviously, the the amount of work became more, and I just absolutely tanked high school. They passed me by like 1%, and I think they did that just so that I wouldn't bring the entire average down below 100%. I literally just absolutely tanked high school. And I took a great lesson that I related to from my high school days from Patrick Mouratoglou, who's a tennis coach. And in this Netflix docuseries that you can watch called The Coach's Handbook or Playbook, he talks about how he had a star tennis student that knew that she was talented. She had the reputation that she was this upcoming, this really talented tennis player. But she was playing a match against a less talented player, but that less talented player was just leaving it all out on the court that day. And Mouratoglou recounts how his star tennis player just stopped eventually going for the shots that he knew she could get. And eventually she lost the game. But afterwards, she had every logical reason why she lost the game. Well, there was this reason and that point, and the sun, and then there was someone in the audience that, and the whatever excuses, didn't sleep well, and so my energy went, whatever logical, and she believed them as well. But she had a reason. And he realized, after working with her, that in fact it was more psychologically comfortable for her to lose the game, have every excuse why, had she been able to give her all, of course she would have won, because then she retained her identity of being this talented player that obviously would have won had these other things not happened. And that was more psychologically comfortable compared to her giving her all and still losing. Because then what would that say? That became an identity crisis. And that was exactly the same with me. I, not realizing it at the time, was driven by the emotions that caused me to prevent giving my all at school, because what if I gave my all and I still didn't do well? Maybe that would be the thing to reveal that I'm unintelligent. And so we find that we can literally tank projects, goals, and not even realize that we're doing it. We externalize the reasons into all other things that we actually believe at the time, unless we've developed the ability to introspect and to have the models that we've been discussing here today. I'm really trying to do this to really give you a solid foundation of the mindset and the repercussions. And then, also because of time, I'm going to go really, really quickly through some slides that show how this unfolds into behaviors. But I'll also, because I see a lot of you taking notes, if you like, I'll put my email address up at the end that you can take a photo of. And then I can also send you some follow-up resources and slides and stuff that can share this with you. So rather take the time to just listen and absorb it and think about how it applies to you, and then you can get the slides and stuff like that afterwards. A growth mindset is the opposite. It's the belief that our intelligence, talent, creativity, and character are not fixed traits, and that through effort and method, we can become smarter, more talented. We can literally even change the type of person who we are. And when we believe that, then we realize that everything that we experience, every win that we experience, and every setback that we experience, every failure, is merely seen through the lens of, well, how could I have done something different? Or what effort? Maybe I have to put in more effort or redirect my effort somewhere else. And because of that, I've now learned, I've become smarter, I've gained experience, and so next time, I will literally be more intelligent to be able to deal with this type of situation again. So we're detaching our self-worth and our identity, and we realize that with the right amount of time and effort and method, we can become one of the smartest people compared to somebody who thinks that they're just born with intellect, but they put in no effort and method. And even if they are really smart, what they don't realize is they're spending their entire life only engaging in projects that are going to validate that they are that smart. So they tend to take smaller projects, or sometimes they feel undue stress when they're in bigger projects. And there's a whole lot of list of the kind of emotional stress that comes with having a fixed mindset and having high natural talent. I just want to read you, before we get into the behaviors, one of my favorite excerpts from this man. This is the man who invented the IQ test, Alfred Binet, a 1920s Frenchman who invented it, not to test what IQ, what intelligence we were born with, but rather to see which children were not benefiting from the public schooling system so they could re-engage them in a different way to allow them to to grow and become smarter. And so this is from one of his seminal pieces. He says, a few modern philosophers assert that an individual's intelligence is a fixed quantity, a quantity which cannot be increased. I love this next line. He says, we must protest and react against such brutal pessimism. I love it. With practice, training, and above all method, we manage to increase our attention, our memory, our judgment, and literally become more intelligent than we were before. So there we're seeing everything through the lens of effort and method. It's also backed by neuroscience. We know that as we're learning new things, our brain cells, neurons, are forming synaptic connections. Those synaptic connections, which you're going to see happen right over here, will then become strengthened into neural pathways. We know that through training, the neural density in our brain starts to increase. So we know that through effort and method, we can become smarter, become more talented, more creative. We can change our character, who we are as a person. We know that to be true. And so we know that we're not either somebody who has a fixed mindset or somebody who has a growth mindset, but rather we're on a continuum. And there are certain things that trigger us to move more into our fixed mindset or that trigger us to move more into our growth mindset. To think that somebody just has a fixed mindset is a pretty fixed way of thinking, actually. So what I want to share with you as I close up here is how does this impact us personally and impact how we work as a team to be able to get those six norms? The first thing is to acknowledge that mindset is not just something in your head. In today's hyper-individualized Western world, especially in the Western world, we feel that we're all so independent. Like if somebody's got a bad attitude or they've got the wrong mindset, like go out and sort yourself out, come back when you've got a better mindset. What we fail to realize is that actually we are products of our environment. If you saw a fish swimming in the lake, you wouldn't just think that the way the fish was swimming had only to do with the fish. No, it's also got to do with the currents, with the environment, with the plants, the other fish, and so on. Similarly, you and your team are like a garden of carrots. If you saw a carrot that was wilting, you wouldn't just say that's the carrot that needs to sort itself out. No, you would look at what's the quality of the soil, what are the nutrients, what are the elements that are doing, what are the other plants around, the other carrots. How is that impacting that particular carrot? And so here we've got the carrot framework that I showed you earlier, but I want to add to the framework by saying that there are these environmental cues that will start to shift us, to start to cue us more into a fixed or more into a growth mindset. So we have things like the norms that we observe, the leadership messages, policies, and I'll just, because of the time that we have, I'll just mention performance evaluations. Leaders who believe more, who are more in their fixed mindset, will then tend to prize natural genius, will seek out and reward natural genius in their teams, and promote and positively evaluate. So you start finding that evaluations start looking like the search for natural genius. And that being something that's in an environmental cue, you can see how that naturally would trigger other people, even if they are somebody who naturally has more of a growth mindset. Now they're being evaluated, and they're being evaluated on how they made no mistakes, how they did everything so perfectly, so seamlessly, but you know, same like how we got praised when we were children. That will move them more into their fixed mindset. And then when it comes time for them to start hiring other people into the team, they're going to start looking for people who also display those qualities. And so with this culture starts to develop, right? So we can see that our mindset is influenced by the environmental cues causing a collective mindset that you can see in the bottom right over there. I've already mentioned here that leaders' values based on their mindset seep into the environment, creating two distinct mindset cultures, which are known as a culture of genius or a culture of growth. These are terms coined by Mary Murphy, who wrote an amazing book explaining this. And a culture of genius may sound great. And in both cultures, you want really smart people, but you want people, it more alludes to the whole thing of innate genius. This idea, this fixed mindset idea that people are born as innate geniuses, now we need to seek out and find and promote those geniuses. So what lands up happening is with this fixed mindset, which I've summarized here just as this idea that either you've got it or you don't, that innate brilliance is prized and success depends on being seen as having natural brilliance. That's at the assumption and belief. That's the assumption and beliefs that these environmental cues will instill. And so therefore, on an emotional level, we can see that it starts to evoke the fear of not appearing intelligent. That mistakes and failure feel threatening. There's anxiety around not belonging or not being good enough. This is not an exhaustive list, but you can relate to this. And as a result, it drives us to be internally competitive. Because we all now need to stand out as being the genius, right? So we can get ahead in the company. We overly avoid risks or failure. We hesitate to share ideas or seek feedback. Because maybe if I share ideas, someone else will get credit for it. Let me hold this idea to myself. Or let me make sure that I get credit for it, right? Cutting corners to show results. Putting perfection before progress. Trying to fit some stereotype of genius. And when those become the norms that people start to see, it just goes back into the environment and starts perpetuating this culture of genius that's based on a fixed mindset. Now, those six norms that I mentioned to you, you can see the opposites of those on the top right there. That's what we don't want, right? But we know it logically, but the whole point of today is for me to share with you, but emotionally, driven by our narratives, we know that that is the problem. So as a closing slide, because I see that the umbrella hook is about to come around my neck over here. I know, thank you. Thank you, I'm just kidding. With a growth mindset, I'm not going to go and read through all of it here for you, but you can see how this does the exact opposite. Just that simple shift in our sense that ourselves and other people can literally grow our intelligence, character, talent through effort and method raises the level of expectation that we have in each other, in ourselves, and we land up giving more support. We land up giving more resources, more opportunities to develop those qualities through effort and method, which at the end will help us create a culture of growth and achieve those six norms. And it's these six norms that will help you to unlock growth in an increasingly uncertain world. So final thoughts to close off. In a fixed mindset, we're more focused on proving ourselves than improving ourselves. This seeps into our culture, it shapes our emotions, drives our behaviors, and ultimately limits the six crucial norms that we spoke about. Whereas in a growth mindset, we're more focused on improving ourselves than on proving ourselves. And so a culture of growth really unlocks these six norms. I know I sped right through at the start here. If you would like to get some follow-up material, including these slides that I can share with you as a handout, please drop me a mail. I'll be more than happy to share. And I know that sometimes we leave these with more questions than answers. And there are some very common misconceptions around growth mindset. You may be wondering some of them yourselves. And you're more than welcome to drop me a mail and I'll be happy to answer. Thank you so much. Please give a big round of applause as well for everyone who came up right here at the beginning and did our experiment. I really enjoyed my time with you here today. Thank you so much for having me. And enjoy the rest of
and
the conference.
Before you run off, you may not remember this. I hope you do. In 2017, we did a similar experiment on SAFM during my radio show.
Yes.
And I was completely tricky. I blocked him out for a good few minutes, and then eventually he got through. And that was based on watching many mentalist videos and yours. So maybe there is a trick to this thing. I don't know.
Yeah, half an art and half a science.
We don't know. We'll see. But thank you so much, Tugilan. Let's give him a round of applause.
Thank you very much, everyone. Appreciate being here.